most interesting guests in the music industry, entertainment, art, and politics step into the studio for Turning Point with Frank McKay. And now, Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Welcome to Turning Point. Our very special guest today is Butch Patrick. Many know Butch from Eddie Munster on the classic TV show, The Munsters. Butch, how are you?
I'm doing great.
All right. Hey, you lost your father figure on the show not too many years ago, right? Fred Gwynne.
Yes. What about Fred?
We lost him a few years back.
Back in 1992. It's actually been quite a while.
Oh, has it been that long?
My cousin Vinny was his last role, yeah.
No kidding. Oh, so, scratch that. We lost him a while ago. Were you close to him at the end?
Well, not really. He had pretty much estranged himself from Hollywood, had moved back to Maryland, had a large farm that he lived on, and had tried to separate himself from being Herman Munster. I did speak to him on the phone a few times and saw him briefly in the early 90s. But other than that, no, I hadn't had much contact with him, although I did have a lot of contact with Al Lewis and Yvonne DiCarlo late in their lives.
Yeah, Al I knew a little bit. He was a great guy, just a character, real character.
You always remembered meeting Al Lewis, whether it was good or bad.
Yeah, well, it was good. I always enjoyed his company. Fred Gwynne, it was certainly a Shakespearean quality actor in many regards. He seemed like he always resented the fact that he had to play Herman Munster and had to put on the costume and everything. Would you agree?
Yeah, the show, the show was popular. He became pigeonholed and sort of not really typecast, but you'd go into a movie when he would be himself and people would be murmuring, there's Herman Munster, Fred Gwynne, Herman Munster, and it became his calling card character, which I think he took offense to in the fact that he did so much more with his life other than being Herman Munster. He was a true Renaissance man. I mean, he was a sculptor, he was an artist, he was, like you say, a voiceover guy, he was a Shakespearean actor, he did all kinds of great things, and a musician, he did it all.
He lost a child while on the set. Am I correct?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, that's something that obviously no parent should ever have to bury a child. Did you sense it from him that this was weighing heavily on his mind? Or
no, you got to remember, I was only 11 years old and I was immersed in school, and I when I wasn't on the set, I was not I was always busy with my books. So a lot of the day-to-day trials and tribulations of the show, I was pretty much insulated from.
Yeah, you were kind of segregated from the rest of the cast in that sense.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
Who did you hang out with back then? What about guys like Jay North and some of the other Hollywood kids?
Hang out with anybody in Hollywood, because I lived 30 miles from Hollywood, and I was the only kid on the Universal lot for those 2 years. So the only time I would have any interaction with any other child actors would be when they came and did a guest role on the Munsters, like Bill Mumy, Peter Robbins, or Rusty Stevens, and a few other kids that came and did guest roles on the Munsters once in a while.
How many times a year were you shooting, or how often during the year?
We did 39 weeks the first year, which was pretty much a full plate, and 31 weeks the second year.
Wow. I mean, did you hate this?
No, not at all.
You were kind of segregated from the other kids. You didn't feel like you were missing out on this.
No, I just, I had my weekends, and Mondays and Tuesdays were fairly easy days. So you had 3 makeup days during the week, and then my stepdad was a pro ball player. So I would spend time at the ballpark on the weekends with professional baseball players, which was a really cool release. So I had a pretty great childhood.
Who was your stepdad?
His name was Ken Hunt. He played for the Yankees. He was Mickey Mantle's roommate. He's buried next to Roger Maris. Then he went to the Angels in the expansion in 1961. And then after that, he injured himself. And then he was traded to the Washington Senators, the Gil Hodges era. Don Zimmer was a third base. Frank Howard was our power hitter. It was a pretty interesting team. And then after that, he went to the Chicago Cubs, where Leo DeRocher was managing.
He had a pretty interesting childhood.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you say it really didn't affect you in a negative way. And I never really thought about it like that. But you had your weekends. And most kids are, going to school during the day, and their interaction with the other kids in school.
Yeah, and like I said, I lived a long way from the studios, so I actually had an entirely different set of friends that I always kept throughout my life, and the acting was just a sideline.
Now, that's interesting. Are you still in touch with some of your childhood buddies?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I just came back from Macon, Missouri, where I lived in the eighth grade, and reconnected with some childhood students, some friends that were in class with me. My grandma's house is haunted back there, so we're talking about purchasing it and making it into a bed and breakfast. Maybe a TV show out of the deal, you know, Eddie Munster's Haunted Bed and Breakfast in Macon, Missouri. We don't know. May work out. Testing the waters on that. Got the new Mockingbird Lane is going to be aired in 10 days. I'm curious to see how that's received by the public. There's rumors, you know, that you either love it or you hate it situation. Got a part in a new upcoming movie. A friend of mine's producing a movie. Well, not really a friend, an agent friend. Contacted me about the lead in a Dexter slash Punisher type show called Dr. Orb, where I murder people who get away with murder, literally.
Ah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Vigilante type stuff.
A vigilante type, you got it.
How many films have you done in all your years here?
In actual feature films?
Yeah, or films, or independent films?
I did 17 feature films.
No kidding.
And I did three other series other than the Munsters. I did The Real McCoys, I did the General Hospital, and then I did Lidsville, a Saturday morning, 1971 Saturday morning with Charles Nelson Reilly. Live-action fantasy thing that's actually being made into a 3D DreamWorks animated movie this year.
I remember Lidsville. I think in syndication it was for a little while.
Yeah, it was an ABC, then it was NBC, then it was bought up by NBC. But it was a very popular H.R. Puffin stuff, and then Lidsville were the two most popular Croft shows of all time.
Yeah.
And like I said, and DreamWorks is making it into an animated 3D flick.
Did you have any interactions with the Croft brothers?
With the who?
With the brothers that created the shows.
Sid and Marty?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw Sid not too long ago. I've seen him several times, and occasionally I'll do a convention with them. In fact, I'm actually working right now on a CroftCon exclusive pop culture convention tour that I would love to implement.
Yeah, well, that's incredible. They had some career. I mean, Puffin stuff.
Yeah, they did evening shows. They did Donnie and Marie, the Brady the Variety Hour. They did feature films. They did the Spit and Image was a fantastically cool show with all the puppets of the politicians and stuff.
Are they both alive? Pardon my ignorance, but they're both alive.
They
how old are they?
Sid's about 82, and I think Marty's about 76.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah.
You talk about a unique career they had. I mean, that was
I know. That's why I think that their conventions would do really well.
I think you're right. I absolutely think you're right. How do you like the convention scene? It's fun, right? It's enjoyable.
Yeah, if I didn't like it, I wouldn't do it, to be honest with you. But it's really nice meeting the people. And what I'm doing now is all the people that I'm running into, I'm utilizing their stories and their comments on a 50th anniversary Munster's coffee table book that'll be out in 2014. I want to make it very interactive and very much a fan-based portrayal of the Munsters and what the Munsters meant to people growing up, not only their generation, but their kids and their grandkids' generations.
You know, we just spoke to fake Jan. You know, fake Jan from...
Yeah, Jerry.
Yeah, Jerry. Very, very nice. And, you know, we were talking to her about the whole scene, and it's unique, the relationship.
Because of the term fake Jan. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's what I said. You're not offended by the term? And she's like, no, it's...
It was very funny. We were at an autograph show recently at a Dead Man's Curve car club. I do a lot of hot rod shows because I enjoy the cars. And she came up to me and she says, no, I'm not. I'm fake Jan. I'm not the plum. I says, you're not a plum. You're a peach.
Does she still look good?
She's sweet. She looks good as well. Yeah, she embraces it so much. And actually, the movie that I'm speaking of, she's going to be in the Dr. Orb movie as well.
I'll tell you that, you know, I said this to her, and she was lovely. Jerry was very, very nice. The idea that she embraced it and she owns it, you know, the whole idea of fake Jan, I think is a very smart way to go. In a different sense, Adam West has made a huge, monstrous career out of the pop culture movement that's going on. That's you know, next to nothing. I mean, if you look at history, I can't think of anything that compares to pop culture the way it's being embraced now. I mean,
I know it's a huge. It's one of the things that I started doing when I was doing the shows. The Munsters falls into a very unique category. There's about five definite definite genres that I could go to shows at. We were huge merchandise, a lot of toys, a lot of collectibles, so that's one.
Yeah.
Then it was horror sci-fi, that's two. Then we got the hot rods and car shows, that's three, because we had the cool hot rods.
Yeah.
Number four is you have pop culture just in general. And then number five, you have your straight autograph shows, which is just Hollywood in general. I mean, it really falls into a lot of – and you also have – you have Comic Cons. I do Comic Cons and things of that nature because there were Munster comic books and anything to do with pop culture. The 60s, 64, 65, 66, the greatest years of pop culture happened to be our 3 years.
Yeah, that's unique. I've never actually heard it laid out that way, but you're absolutely right on. I mean, that's...
Yeah. The neat part about that is I do three or four of each a year. I don't wear out my welcome, and I don't go to the well too often, and yet it keeps me busy, and it's perfect for me because it allows me to interact with the fans, which helps the book. And it's fun. You know, it's a travel. You get to see the country. You get to catch up with old friends from all over the world. And at the same time, you actually make a few bucks. It's
yeah.
kind of like my residuals.
Yeah.
I don't get rerun money from anything to do from anything from pre-74. I look at this as it's kind of a residual process, and that's why I like it.
Well, yeah, that's a great way to look at it. We're here with Butch Patrick.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
We're here with Butch Patrick. I think also you're an interesting study in the idea of the changing of television and the way that the performers were treated. And you mentioned pre-residuals. I think even the folks on Gilligan's Island didn't get much on residuals, right? And
right.
Those shows were played constantly. But once you got past that certain point, and, you know, I don't know what year it was. I'll ask you. You're probably an expert on that.
Well, during the pre-residual era, you know, it was, first of all, they didn't have syndication at all. So the thing we would be doing would be you'd work year-round, and they didn't have reruns, and they never thought about having reruns. So syndication didn't exist until 1972, and it happened, as I remember, it was by, it was kind of an emergency mode. A station went to dead air and didn't have anything, and they slapped up some reruns of The Addams Family, believe it or not, I think was the show.
Mm.
And they noticed that people watched it intently and liked it, and they said, well, wow, if they enjoy watching reruns of old shows, imagine the money we could save by showing shows that we already have in the can, no production costs, and we can still charge advertising revenue. And that's kind of how they came up with the idea.
That's very interesting. What year was that?
I believe it was like 71.
71, and that's the first time.
Maybe earlier, but I believe it was the late 60s, early 70s, and then in 1974 they changed the law to be retroactive. I mean, excuse me, it was not retroactive, but it went on from that point on to where people were protected to like 5% of the initial gross into perpetuity.
Yeah, I know, you know, growing up, I mean, I was born in 1967, so I grew up with reruns. I never even thought of the idea of what was the origin of the rerun, and that's actually a pretty... that's fascinating.
I mean, they used to have summer replacements, but they never reran stuff.
That's interesting. I mean, I grew up with Brady Bunch reruns and Munster reruns and
yeah, that's what
else.
It was. If you were of that era, where everything was already in rerun.
Do you have any statistics on how many countries the Munsters have actually appeared in?
The number that I've seen in print is 44.
44. That's amazing. Just amazing.
It's very big in South America. They love the vampires. Los Monstruos, real popular, although I have had I get fan mail from all over the globe. European market's really solid. Australia loves it. And as far as, you know, I don't know too much about the rest of the Asia, this or that. I know Asia loves Western culture, pop culture, because Aaron Murphy, a good friend of mine, goes, Tabitha from Bewitched, as you might recognize the name. She goes to Japan often, and they really adore her over there. She's like Jerry Lewis in France.
No kidding. That's funny. Yeah, actually, she was an adorable little girl, and I don't know, did she do much acting as she got older?
You know, I don't think so, because I would have probably noticed had she continued to do more acting. I'm sure she did a bit, but she was raising a family. She's got five or six kids.
Yeah. Well, how about the whole concept of kid stars, and there's been so many documentaries on it, and, you know, E! and Biography Channel has done the negatives on the downside of being a child star, and you know you've had battles with all kinds of things, and I know Billy Gray from
Father Knows
Best, and you know he had his battles. How much of How much of this can you trace back to, you know, being a child star? And, you know, you don't have any complaints about your upbringing.
Well, you know what I've learned in going through treatment myself finally and getting straightened out, and you know, I'll have 2 years of sobriety next month, and what I learned was the fact that you're born with a gene, so it's not like you don't have any willpower. And if you're not educated to how to deal with it, you have a tendency to be enabled by friends and family, and you know, everybody kind of treats you a little differently because you're in television. And if you take advantage of that, you can continue to take, you know, you can continue to get away with bad behavior. To be honest with you, is what happens.
Yeah.
People have a tendency to cut you more slack than you're entitled to, and you get that you get the sense of entitlement sometimes. Not everybody, but, you know, some people do. And then the fact that people, like for me, when I would travel, everywhere you would go, you'd be picked up at the airport in a limousine, and people, whatever drug of choice or whatever you wanted to do to get into trouble, they were more than willing to have you, you know, to help you along the way. It's kind of like rock and roll. You know, it's like sex, drugs, and rock and roll in the 60s.
Sure.
Acceptable lifestyle. It was a badge of honor, almost. So the thing now is the people, I mean, some of them wind up dead. I mean, there's been a lot of fatalities. You mentioned Billy Gray with pot smoking and stuff, but you know, Lauren Chapin, who played Kitten on that show, had a terrible time. Had a really bad go of it until she got straightened out. I mean, she was on heroin and she had a bunch of, you know, issues.
Well, she had prostitute. You know, she admitted to prostitution.
I don't want to bring that up, but yeah.
Sure.
And Lisa Loring, who was Wednesday Addams, is a dear friend of mine. She had a real tough battle with heroin. And is much better now. But anyway, the thing is I don't believe it's the industry, to be perfectly honest with you. I think being famous helps, no doubt, because the industry doesn't really create anything. It's just people in the industry that allow you the latitude of being Dr. Feelgoods for Elvis and Michael Jackson's and this and that. You know, the people that are supposed to be watching out for you have a tendency not to. Dana Plato's a perfect example. This woman was desperately in need of help, and no one reached out to her.
Yeah, just,
you know,
it's amazing.
Had I been straightened out myself and been in the position I am now, I would have. But at the same time, I was in the same predicament she was. I was, you know, using and drinking and in denial up to my eyeballs. But I was not as bad off as she was, and maybe I was a little stronger. I don't know what the situation was, but it was a sad scenario because I knew Todd. I know Todd very well, and I knew Gary, and I knew Dana, and it was just sad to see her just kind of disintegrate in front of everybody. And no, I mean, Wayne Newton tried to, you know, bail her out of jail and did the right thing, but when she got bailed out of jail, that wasn't the answer. They should have said, why is she in jail to begin with, and let's fix that problem.
Yeah, no question.
So anyway, I don't, to answer your question, it's kind of a long roundabout way.
No,
I don't believe it's the industry. I think I would have probably been a pain in the butt whether I had been a lawyer or an architect or whatever. The thing is you're born with the gene, and if you don't learn how to deal with it and address it, then the industry has a tendency to give you a green light for bad behavior.
I think you touched on some important stuff there. I mean, you come into contact with athletes, and I'm sure you've seen this growing up, especially being that close to a professional athlete, your stepdad. But the young athletes that are being treated much differently than anyone else in the in their schools. I mean, just you're talking about kids in grade school. If they look like they can, you know, run the ball, you know, better than anyone else, or you know, hit a ball harder than anyone else.
There are a couple of things that are different in society. Huge differences that between the 60s and today. Number one, my stepdad made X amount of dollars, and I actually made more money than he did, which was in the mid $30,000 range. So it wasn't like you were making 400 times as much as the average guy as athletes do today. There wasn't that big of a window. A lot of the ball players back then had winter jobs. They were consultants. They were car salesmen. They owned car dealerships. They had another form of income because baseball hadn't broken the $100,000 a year thing.
Yeah.
At that point, I think Mickey Mantle was the first one to do it.
Yeah, I was going
to
say your stepfather's roommate broke that.
So that was one of the deals that was differently. And today, acting is a lot of times, and even though back then it happened, but not as much as today, that parents are living vicariously through their children, because there's so many of these dance shows and these reality type shows that are throwing money at these families, these regular families, and then they want to pursue it into acting, and somebody picks them up and drags the whole family into it as well. That has a tendency to really screw one's kids up, kid's life up much more than the actual working on a set in a controlled atmosphere is one thing, and getting a tutor and getting a good education is one. But being these reality show based situations where they're actually wanting bad behavior for ratings is quite different.
You mentioned sobriety. You're in a program?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you do the reality shows with who's it, Dr. Drew? And
No, I wouldn't do that. I went into a legitimate Oasis treatment center. The gentleman who actually runs the Oasis and owns it was the first intervention A&E, Jim Antonovich.
Yeah.
So Jim A left the intervention show on A&E because they wanted him to allow people to get drunk before they would be, you know, come into the property, and he would have nothing to do with it. So he did the first six or eight interventions and then left them because of the Hollywood machine wanted certain things to be done for ratings, and he said no thank you. And then the Dr. Drew situation, as you know, nothing against Dr. Drew personally, I've never met him, but I believe the celebrity rehabs were a vehicle for him to get to where he wanted to get, where he is now, doing the show that he wanted to do. And they asked me and they interviewed me about being in rehab, a celebrity rehab, which was $35,000 for a 21-day stint, which was actually pretty good money.
Yeah.
But nobody got better.
Yeah, right.
And what I did is I asked a friend and an agent, and he said, as a friend, I would tell you no, because it doesn't seem to help anybody. And as an agent, I would tell you no, because I don't think anybody's career has gotten any better after doing a stint on celebrity rehab. He goes, I can't think of anybody whose career has flourished after that. So
yeah.
He said no on both sides. And I was good friends with Jeff Conaway, and look what happened to him.
Yeah, it's horrible. And when you're dealing with recovery and somebody's...
Yeah, it's a sad situation because he was up to his eyeballs in meds from his back surgeries and a lifelong cocaine addiction, as was I, but I wasn't as bad off as he was.
Yeah, we're here with Butch Patrick.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
We're here with Butch Patrick. How long was your bout?
Was my stint there?
Yeah.
Well, I went in for the whole 90 days, and as a matter of fact, I'm sitting in a sober living apartment right now. I live by myself about a mile from the property, and I travel extensively, and I'm pretty much a goodwill ambassador for Oasis these days.
Yeah.
So what I do is I'm still close to the program, and I go to three or four meetings a week. But I'm not a hands-on person because I'm on the road so much.
Yeah, it's, you know, certainly when you're dealing with issues like this, it kind of puts things in perspective. And Jeff
it's
Conway's
an insurance policy for me. The closer I am to there, the better it is for me, and the better it is for me to share my success with other people. Because I was out there for 41 years solid, and I was a serious player. I didn't do heroin, but I did about everything else you could do, and survived a car wreck, a broken back, one kidney. I survived cancer. So for me, I can legitimately talk to people on many levels of how it worked for me. Is I can only recommend what to do, and I can only show by example.
When you go to the Comic Cons and
yep.
different shows, it seems like, and again, it seems like a different crew of people. They're more the computer tech nerds and that type of crew. I mean, is and I'm sure there's drugs everywhere, but it doesn't seem like a high-end drug crowd.
Well, you know what it is? It's a different kind of drugs. When I was growing up, it was, pot and drinking and cocaine and this and that and powdered cocaine. Today, it's pharmaceutical drugs, designer drugs. Most kids can go in most – if they went around to the – let me put it this way. If a kid was looking for Oxycontins or Valiums or Klonopins or any of the drugs that are today Xanax – that they're looking for, there's a very good chance that somebody in their immediate family has them in their medicine chest, whether it's a grandma or an aunt or an uncle or a parent directly. They have them in their medicine chest. This country is totally prescription crazy. You know, we're like 20% of the world's population, and we take 80% of the prescription drugs.
Amazing.
It's so upside down.
Yeah, it's amazing. Look at
the
Michael Jackson.
That we have at the treatment center is it's not an alcohol. I mean, we have our alcoholics. Don't get me wrong; it's part of the problem. But our main problem is prescription drugs. Kids that are on opiates.
Did you follow the Michael Jackson trial?
The Michael Jackson what?
The trial of
yes, I did.
Yeah, I'm talking about his doctor's trial, not the.
Yeah, I mean the same thing happened with Elvis. I mean people don't say no to him. I mean Paul Peterson, who's a huge advocate for his minor consideration.
Donna Reed show, right?
Pardon?
The Donna Reed show, Paul.
Yeah, Donna Reed show. Jeff Stone, he's formed the Minor Consideration, which is a watchdog committee for kid actors now and then. In Hollywood, and he was an alcoholic who got himself straightened out. And I asked him one day, I said, well, what do you attribute all this to, Paul? And he says, nobody ever tells these people no. If someone would have said no to Michael Jackson, he'd still be alive. But because he's Michael Jackson, everybody, he just surrounds himself with yes men.
Yeah.
Same thing with Elvis.
We're here with Butch Patrick. Butch, talking about your life and talking about your career as an adult, what was the turning point in your life? What was the turning point in your career?
Well, the turning point for when it went bad was I did a movie in Brazil in 1969, 3 months with no teacher and no parent down there, and I could pretty much run amok. As my sister says in my acceptance ceremonies when I get my chip, she says, I left as Richie Cunningham, and I came back as John Lennon.
Oh, jeez.
In 3 months. So that was my summer of 42, was the summer of 69.
Yeah.
And as far as the turning points recently, November 21st of 2010, when I entered the Oasis Treatment Center and accepted a role of learning why I was where I was at and trying to become part of the solution and not part of the problem, was a turning point for me.
Well, listen, congratulations on your recovery. And,
thank you.
You know, and best of luck to you on this. And we do want to mention the Monkees Convention.
Oh, please do. In fact, yeah, bring that up because I have a very good story about the Monkees. That's a good one.
Yeah, let's do that. In March of 2013, there'll be a Monkees Convention, and it's probably the first big one since the death of Davy Jones. And go ahead, Butch.
Well, you know, I did a Monkees show when the Beatles came on the set of the Munsters when I was 11 or 12 years old, and I missed meeting them, and I was devastated. You know, nobody even got me an autograph picture. They were there. I missed them. I go, oh, my God. I guess I had gone home early that day, or they came on a Friday night, and they were working late. One thing led to another, but I never met the Beatles. So about 2 years later, when the Monkees were on TV, they were damn near as big as the Beatles in America. I mean, they were huge. They had a TV show. They were, like, really big players. So I got an interview. And I went up for a Monkees interview, and I got the part, and I came home, and I told all my friends, because normally I wouldn't mention anything about this to my peers, but the Monkees, that was a different story. And I wound up doing their one and only Christmas show. It's a really good episode. I'm a lot of camera time. I'm interacting with all the Monkees themselves, having the time of my life. And now they have these conventions, and I've seen Mickey many, many, many times and Peter many times, but Davey, I'd only run into a couple times since then, once in Chicago 20 years ago, and I was just at a show. Maybe 2 months before he passed away, I think it was in February or March, and for some reason I went over and I'm talking to him, and I was going to see him in 2 months. I was going to say, you know, I will see you in 2 months at this other convention, at this car show, and for some reason I took a picture over to him and asked him to sign it for me, and I never do that. I very rarely ask people to sign autographs, but for some reason I was compelled to do this, and 2 weeks later he passed away.
Oh, boy.
So I have a picture of him signing a picture for me, which I will treasure forever, but if you want to come out and meet me, or Jan, or Jerry. What does she call herself?
Fake Jan,
or myself, or other people that have something to do with the Monkees. It's going to be a great convention for a good cause. Please come out and join us, and it'll be a tribute to Davy Jones. And he was really a talent, wonderful guy. He was always pleasant to the people, and he will be missed.
We are speaking with our special guest today. Was. And still is Butch Patrick, and Butch, we hopefully will see you all at the Monkees Convention. And Butch, you know, congratulations on being a big part of pop culture history.
Thank you. I'm glad I could help.
Our special guest again, Butch Patrick, otherwise known as Eddie Munster. Our next week we'll be back here again on Turning Point. Thank you, Butch.
Thank you.
Turning Point with Frank McKay is brought to you by Herman, Katz, Congemi, and Klein, Duffy & Duffy, Gold Coast Bank, Heartland Business Center, Morgan Stanley and Smith Barney of PC Wealth Management, and the Hagedorn Little Village School in Seaford, New York. Turning Point with Frank McKay was produced by GVP Digital Media in Ronkonkoma, New York. Executive producers Frank McKay and Harry Oates. Associate producers Kristen and John McKay. Audio and studio engineering Brittany Fergo and Francis Kazmarek. Hotel and accommodations provided by Ohika Castle Hotel and States in Huntington, New York. Transportation services provided by Mark of Elegance Limousine in Hop Hog, New York. Catering services provided by Chella Bagels of Selden, New York.